This is an ABC podcast.
Fatalo Fatu, come na Māori and Goodfella morning. I'm Eggy Tupou and this is Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Good to be back in the hot seat. While coming up on the show, Torres Strait Islanders upset their class action against the Australian government on climate change impacts fails.
I have a message for the Prime Minister. Minister Bowen and Minister Watt, we see you. How dare you? Wake up. The world is watching. Our fearless ancestors are watching.
And Samoan locals still left in the dark about the sunken Navy ship's future.
We're concerned that if the ship stays underwater, rusting metal could harm coral reefs and marine life. And if the Samoa and New Zealand governments have agreed to leave it there, our village was not informed.
And the Pacific Police Band Tattoo will see bands from across the Pacific compete at PNG's 50th Independence Anniversary celebrations.
It's more like a competition, but, you know, it's an opportunity for us to, you know, exchange, you know, our culture and all this stuff. So it will be an opportunity to meet, mingle around with our Pacific brothers.
Those stories and more, but I say vinaka. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in Samoa, residents of Tafatoala village say they've been left in the dark about plans to leave the sunken New Zealand Navy vessel Manawanui where it lies. The agreement was confirmed last week by both the Samoan and New Zealand governments, but locals say they've had no say in the matter and they fear potential environmental impacts if the ship remains in place. The ABC's Samoa reporter Adele Fruin has the story.
For Tafatoala village Mayor Talo'ai Leonova Sasso, the decision to leave the sunken Manawanui New Zealand Navy vessel in the water outside his village came as a shock.
No one in our village, including the chiefs and council, has discussed the vessel's status. We haven't been informed whether it will be removed or left where it sunk. We're concerned that if the ship stays underwater, rusting metal could harm coral reefs and marine life. And if the Samoa and New Zealand governments have agreed to leave it there, our village was not informed.
The incident in October last year created worldwide headlines, with the New Zealand government facing criticism over its handling of the sinking and the ongoing environmental impacts. Now, more than 9 months on, parts of the sea surrounding the ship remain a no-go zone, affecting the local village's ability to fish and generate income. Talo'ai Leono says he believes the only acceptable option for keeping the sunken vessel in Samoa is to lift it from the sea, place it on land and turn it into a tourist attraction. However, Samoa's caretaker Prime Minister Fiume Naomi Mutua'afa told local media there are no plans to remove the sunken vessel from its current location.
The initial priority was to assess the situation and respond to its impacts, with a strong focus on environmental concerns. We received assistance from the New Zealand government regarding those needs. Discussions followed about the vessel's future and financial compensation for affected districts, with two governments involved. Each held separate deliberations and had many discussions. I've been informed that both governments have agreed to leave the vessel where it sank.
Caretaker Prime Minister Fiume says there is financial compensation for the affected families. However, she says it will be issued by the new government only after Samoa's general election in August. She says there are ongoing discussions about the amount for the villages and the Samoan government.
The second part involves deciding how much to compensate the government for its response efforts and compensation for the affected districts. Now deliberations are being carried over how much the compensation will be.
Despite confirmation of compensation for affected villages, Talo'ai Leono says the people of Tafatoala village are frustrated over the process and the lack of consultation.
We were told a seminar would happen this month, but after waiting and contacting key government officers for updates, we were simply asked to be patient because there are ongoing works that are being done and that the funds are still with the caretaker government. As for the compensation, we have been informed about it. The compensation has been given by the New Zealand government to our government. But we're saddened that our village has waited so long for compensation, nearly a year since the incident in October, and still nothing has been received.
And that was Tafatoala village mayor Talo'ai Leono Vasaso, ending that report by Adele Fruin. Now, the political fallout between the Cook Islands and New Zealand shows no sign of healing. After Cook Islands struck deals with China, New Zealand cut off millions of dollars of critical aid funding. Now, New Zealand's top officials, the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, have announced they won't be attending Cook Islands Constitution Day celebrations next month. That will commemorate 60 years of self-governance and free association with New Zealand. So joining me now to discuss what this means for Cook Islands is opposition leader Tina Brown. That I say, kia ora, Tina. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Kia ora, and thank you for having me on your program.
Absolutely. Ms. Brown, what does this move by the New Zealand government show about the relationship between itself and Cook Islands at the moment?
Well, I think it shows that the problem has yet to be fixed. I know that that was something that was discussed at in debate during the last parliament. And I think the country and certainly our side of the chambers have urged our government, our Prime Minister, to fix the problem and let's get on and work on the trust relationship that we once had. The question was asked as to whether New Zealand was going to join us for this very important celebration. This is our 60th year, and the Outer Islands, all the countries in the Cooks are travelling to Rarotonga. And we were informed that, yes, the invites had gone out. I was surprised to get the email last night from ABC that New Zealand will not be attending. It's not going to be a very, very happy celebration, I'm afraid.
And do you think then the Cook Islanders, what are they feeling about, you know, these tensions at the moment?
I would say that 99% of Cook Islanders are wanting our government to fix the problem with New Zealand. We seem to have discussions, and now we're told that the two countries are in discussions by top officials. What exactly that means, I'm not quite sure. I would have liked to see it at the ministerial level, because that appears to be where the root of the problem is. So I think the news is not going to make many Cook Islanders happy, because they will feel, as I do, that the problem is still there.
Yeah. And of course, we understand New Zealand has frozen more than $16 million Australian dollars in aid, you know, after the China deals. What immediate consequences do you see for areas like, I suppose, healthcare and education?
Healthcare, education, I mean, these funds are badly needed. It was downplayed in our budget last month, and you know the reference to New Zealand being patronising, a reference that our Prime Minister made. It's very unfortunate that he used that term, and so it has not improved matters. In fact, it had made matters worse, if they are not already worse.
Yeah, and as I spoke about the China deals, earlier this year, Cook Islands struck that major economic deal with China aimed at supporting the country's economy. I know that you've even described China's influence as frightening, or even warning that, you know, we'll be swallowed up in China's money. So what specific concerns do you have about the societal or even economic impact of things like deep sea mining and infrastructure projects funded by China?
Oh, well, I have many concerns. One is all you need to do is have a look around the Pacific and have a look at the islands that that China is have now assisted, and the Chinese presence in those countries that worries me. Worries me with China becoming involved in our seabed mining. As you may be aware, we're only at the exploration stage with China, and the intelligence and the know-how and the technical knowledge that they have, and that process could be fast-tracked at our disadvantage if China is going to be involved knowing that China is the big provider of cobalt. One of the agreements that was signed was a grant of $4 million, which is a start. Don't get me wrong. I support the islands seeking funding and developing themselves. But the concern we have is that we have a declaration signed by our government, a New Zealand government, in 2001 that talks about consultation before we go out and engage with other countries that might have some impact on questions of security, etc. And we didn't do that. So as far as New Zealand is concerned, so it's not a surprise. It's sad that New Zealand has cut the funding, but we're not surprised. And of course, in my mind, the easiest way to deal with that is to say to New Zealand, look, yes, we should have consulted with you, blah, blah, blah. That's not happening, unfortunately.
Well, Ms. Brown, how do you think the Cook Islands can strike the right balance between partnerships, you know, with China and traditional allies like Australia and New Zealand? Because what does a partnership that truly benefits Cook Islanders look like in your view?
Well, the partnership that we have with New Zealand is far outweighs, in my mind, any partnership that we might have with China. We have a population of about 90 more Cook Islanders in New Zealand and Australia. And we have access to health services, to education. We have a New Zealand passport. Travel for us to many countries is facilitated by the fact that we have New Zealand passport. And so New Zealand has come back and said, well, okay, if you want to be truly independent, we're prepared to enter into those negotiations. But we don't. The majority of our people, we marched, and it was a good turnout. There is no way that our people will support Cook Islands having going independent and having their own passport or a Chinese passport for that matter.
Which is a conversation I know will still be ongoing. But Ms. Brown, look, that's all the time that we have for this morning. But we really do appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Well, many thanks for having me on your show. Thank you.
Me taki. That was Cook Islands opposition leader Tina Brown speaking with me there. And Pacific Beat has reached out to the Cook Islands government for comment, but we have not yet received a response.
Pacific Beat.
Now we head back to Samoa, and for the first time in the country's history, two Fa'afafine leaders will contest the upcoming snap election. Samoans are heading to the polls on August 29 after the government of Fiamea Naomi Mataafa failed to pass its budget in May. While the Fa'afafine community have deep roots in society and tradition, they've historically been excluded from political life. But joining me this morning is Alexander Su'a, the president of Samoa's Fa'afafine Association, with that I say Mālore Soifua. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Alex.
Salofa lava and good morning to Australia Broadcasting News this morning. Thank you for having me on this show this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Alexander, who are the actual two candidates and what do we know about them?
Yes, so these two candidates are not only very highly committed and senior members of our association since its inception in 2005, but they're also now advisory councillors in our association. And these seats are usually and only given to those who have served most diligently in our association, not only as senior members, but now in their role as advisors. And they are Falisao Pule, Seimaleula Vayalia Yosua, and also Silingatusa Alosina Robati. So, it's such a huge pride for us to see that these members of our association have decided to step forward and participate in the upcoming national elections.
Yeah, and how significant is this? You know, not only for the Fafafinge community, but the wider public in Samoa.
Yes, this is a very significant milestone for Samoa as a whole. It also goes to show that I think our community, our Fafafine community, is now ready to be on the spotlight. As you may be aware, our community, even the name itself, Fafafine, carries a derogatory meaning. It usually applies to men who do not perform up to the expected masculine standard of a Samoan man. So in other words, this is where this term comes in, as you are a sissy. And this community, our community of Fafafine and Fatama, had always been socially, politically, culturally disadvantaged. So to have these two members step forward and say, we now want to participate in the national elections. And as you may be aware, for one to run as a political candidate, you need to have a Matai title. Now, both members, Farisau Pule and Silingatusa, are Matai title holders. They have been Matai title holders for more than 10 years now. It goes to show that they have served their families, their villages, their communities, and now they're testing the waters. They want to serve the country, regardless of who and what they are. And Samoa is embracing them, you know, they're very courageous to be part of this upcoming national elections. Mm. So it's highly significant because Falisau Pulevayalia had also participated in the last elections. And now we have Silingatusa. So maybe in the next national elections, we may have three or more, or, you know, but it goes to show that there is that little push that's coming through. But it also goes to show that the very core principle that guides our leaders here in Samoa remains, and that is Uleala ile pule ule tautua. It simply means the way to leadership is through service. And their actions and the support for them from their communities, their villages, their families is high testament to that.
Mm. Thank you for that. And look, as you say, for Falisau Pule and Silingatusa, now that they are stepping up to this, what are some of the key issues that you think are important for the Fafafinge community this election, you know, that you're hoping that are going to be championed by these leaders?
Yes, I think the foremost issue that we really want to see coming forth from these political parties, as you may be aware, there's now three political parties, highly formidable political parties. And as the leader, as the president of our association and representation of the Asoji-S community here in Samoa, is there's a missing element of focusing towards this community of ours. There is a focus on people with disabilities, there is a focus on women, children, but it seems like there is a missing address of our community. Now, with the strength of issues, LGBTQI issues from the Western world, we stand as guardians of not only our culture, but also our identity as Samoans. And this is something a lot of leaders do not know about our role as the Samoa Fafafine Association. We filter what is happening overseas, and we say not everything that is argued for the LGBTQI community in the Western world is relevant here in Samoa. We filter that information, and we have to say we are the experts. We are the specialist of how we want to see that unfold and flourish here in Samoa. So, and that's why if we had to look at what prominent issues the political parties and maybe the next government will have to address, we want them to put their money where their mouth is. And that is, if they want this support, if they want us to stand up and advise them of the most relevant issues that are befitting of our community in Samoa, there should be an allocation of the national budget for the work that we do. Because no one understands the work that we do than us. And we will help our government, we will help our leaders, both church and religious leaders. Because as of now, a lot of the information they're getting is mostly misleading and misconstrued. And they need to talk with us. We are always here. So, following from that, issues such as healthcare, issues such as employment opportunities. So these are some of the issues that we'd like these political parties and perhaps the next government to really address for us. I hope I'm answering the question.
Yes, absolutely. Alex, that is all the time that we have for this morning, but I just want to say faftaitele lava for your time, for sharing about, of course, the upcoming elections there in August.
Thank you so much.
And that was Alexander Su'a, the president of the Samoa Whawhawhinga Association, here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Not yet, Māori. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Anticipation is building among Pacific Island climate activists ahead of a ruling by the International Court of Justice next week. Initiated by Vanuatu's government, the court's been asked for an advisory opinion on the obligation states have to address climate change. Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change, Ralph Reginvanu, says he's optimistic major polluters will be held to account. Whenau Whanua reports.
The outcome of these proceedings will reverberate across generations, determining the fate of nations like mine and the future of our planet.
That was Vanuatu's climate minister and special envoy to the International Court of Justice, Ralph Reginvanu, at the beginning of a series of hearings in December last year. Mr. Reginvanu and his delegation represent the aspirations of the Pacific Islands and Global South, who want developed nations to deliver on their pledges of lowering fossil fuels.
I believe we will see a turning point for climate justice.
In a media briefing on Monday, Mr. Reginvanu told journalists he's optimistic the advisory would favour his case. While the announcement is just an advisory, he says it would be a significant step forward in efforts to hold fossil fuel emitters accountable.
A strong opinion from the court will mean a turning point for climate justice, confirming that polluter states, what we called in our submissions, that readily identifiable group of states, have breached climate vulnerable nations like Vanuatu, including our right to self-determination. We want to see the rule of law apply to the climate crisis, and I think next week we're going to see this with this advisory opinion.
Vishal Prasad of the Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change is equally encouraged. He says the advisory has teeth, as Pacific countries would have the backing of the highest court whenever they confronted developed nations on climate action at any international forum.
Regardless of whether or not it's a negative outcome, SPC as a technical organization which is here to support our members to address climate change and the impacts of climate change, working within the frame of what the ICJ advisory opinion is, regardless of whether or not it's a negative outcome.
But what if the advisory falls short of expectations? Dissatisfaction with climate action announcements have been a common theme. Pacific Community Human Rights official Dr. Miles Young says such a result wouldn't be a step backward in terms of regional efforts to mitigate the impacts of the climate crisis.
Regardless of whether or not it's a negative outcome, SBC as a technical organization which is here to support our members to address climate change and the impacts of climate change, working within the frame of what the ICJ advisory opinion is.
The decision regarding who would host next year's COP remains in the air, but most expect it will be Australia in partnership with Pacific Island nations. Prasad reiterated his support for Australia.
If COP 31 happens in Australia, that becomes a very significant moment for us to push the findings of the ICJ and other international courts and tribunals much more strongly. It's going to be a historic moment.
And that was Vishal Prasad of the Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change. Up next, it's your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
Kia rana koutou and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time of head around the region. It's been a while, but we've got our producer, Carl Evans, in the studio to give us the latest on those headlines. How are you doing?
I'm well, Aggie, and welcome back. I understand you spent some time in my hometown of Canberra.
That's right. And let me tell you, I thought it was cold here. It's colder in Canberra. But it was beautiful. I loved it.
Proper freezing.
Yeah. Okay, let's head into our stories. This one here is talking about the World Health Organization. Now, they're recommending a new treatment to protect vulnerable people against HIV. What's that?
Yeah, that's right. So who's recommending the use of an injectable known as lenacapavir? I hope I pronounced that properly. So L-E-N for short, Len for short. And that's part of a new guideline they've labelled as what they're calling a landmark policy action. So this was reported by FBC, Fiji Broadcasting Corporation. And basically, it's an injectable that people would receive twice a year. And once taken, it acts as a temporary antiviral. And it's shown in trials to prevent almost all HIV infections for a decent period of time. What's more, it's an alternative to daily oral pill treatments, which is how current PrEP and prevention treatments are delivered.
I'm sure a lot of people are asking, when do you think this will start being rolled out?
Yeah, so they've launched these guidelines quite recently, and they've done it just after they got FDA's approval for the treatment, the FDA being the US Food and Drug Administration. And WHO's Director General says they'll work with countries and partners to ensure he's called it an innovation, reaches communities. Look, in Fiji's case, they obviously need all the help they can get. They are now the world's fastest growing HIV epidemic.
Wow.
So, look, no doubt they'll be on that list. Just to recap, the number of new HIV infections in Fiji has risen tenfold. They recorded 1,500 new cases between January and December last year alone.
Wow. Okay, then. Let's head to Tonga, though, where there's more fear over US deportation plans. Yes, I did see this. What's happened?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, the Trump administration may be able to deport immigrants to countries other than their homelands with as little as 6 hours' notice. So that's according to a newly released memo from ICE Acting Director Todd Lyons, which was obtained by Reuters.
Wow.
So, and it states in certain cases, deportees could be sent to a so-called third country in under 24 hours of arrest, provided that they've had a chance to speak with an attorney.
Wow.
So according to Kanivi Tonga, it's something that could impact Tonga if it fails to satisfy US authorities and avoid that potential travel ban. And I'm sure for a lot of families, the prospect of having a loved one sent to another country altogether would be quite daunting.
Yeah, and this is the thing though, has there been any word on whether Tonga will be removed from that potential US travel ban list?
None, according to reports. Tongan officials have yet to disclose the details of that warning or update the public on the status of their response. All we know for now is Tonga's Prime Minister has called the prospect of a travel ban alarming.
Yeah.
We know that they were going to reach out to the US Embassy and then potentially hold meetings, but no information has trickled out yet.
Okay. Well, let's go to Australia because they've kicked off its largest military war games. What's happening here?
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. So Exercise Talisman Sabre commenced yesterday. It is a massive military training exercise comprising of 35,000 soldiers from 19 nations, including Papua New Guinea, Fiji and Tonga. It is the 11th iteration of the Games, and for the first time, PNG has been named as one of the host nations. So the Post Courier says it's a real nod to PNG's increasing military capabilities and, of course, the upcoming 50th Independence Day later this year.
Carl, what kind of exercises are going to be carried out?
Oh, a wide-ranging number of exercises, Aggie. I'm not in the military, unfortunately, but yeah, it's a range of war-fighting simulations from what I've read. Wow. Across land, sea and air. There's going to be firepower demonstrations, mass mobilisation of troops, all types of combat scenarios. And somewhat awkwardly, it actually coincides with Anthony Albanese's visit to China. And many reports have said they'll be watching the games very, very closely as well. So,
okay, yeah. That'll be an interesting one to watch. But look, as always, Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now to another legal case. Torres Strait Islanders have lost their class action against the Australian government for failing to protect their communities from the effects of climate change. The federal government ruled, the federal court ruled the government did not have a duty of care to protect them from the impacts nor to fund measures to help Indigenous communities adapt to the changes. The Islanders had argued that the government had not done enough to cut greenhouse emissions, and that was contributing to the rising sea levels threatening the island. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
At the federal court in Cairns, Torres Strait Islander communities waited for Judge Michael Wigney's findings.
I found that the common law of negligence in Australia, which I'm bound to apply, does not currently support the proposition that harm in the nature of loss of fulfilment of island custom is a compensable species of harm. I was not otherwise persuaded that the evidence established that any breach by the Commonwealth of the alternative duty of care caused the applicants to suffer any loss of damage.
For 4 years, Uncle Paul Kabai and Uncle Pabai Pabai have led the case on behalf of Torres Strait Islanders. They argued the Commonwealth neglected its duty of care by failing to take proper steps to protect communities from the impacts of climate change, including rising sea levels. But Judge Wigney ruled in favour of the government.
The applicant's case against the Commonwealth, applicant's primary case against the Commonwealth, failed not so much because there was no merit in their factual allegations concerning the Commonwealth's emissions reduction targets. Rather, it failed essentially because the common law of negligence in Australia was not a suitable legal vehicle.
Afterwards, Uncle Pabai Pabai was first to address the crowd waiting outside.
My heart is broken for my families and my community. Love has been driven us on this journey for at least 5 years. Love of our families and our communities will keep driving us.
The class action was modelled on successful climate litigation in the Netherlands, but Judge Wigney rejected the claim that the community's cultural loss should be compensated under what's called negligence law. For Uncle Paul Kabai, the ruling came as a shock.
The pain isn't just for me. It's to all Indigenous people of Australia and non-Indigenous people who have been affected by climate change. What any of us going to say to our family when we get home?
This case is the first of its kind in Australia and has been financed through the Grata Fund, a not-for-profit legal fund. 2 years ago, the federal court travelled to Boigu and Sabai, the island homes of both uncles in the Torres Strait. The court heard evidence of coastal erosion, destruction of their ancestors' graves and soil salinity that prevents crops from growing. When handing down his findings, Judge Wigney accepted the negative impact human-induced climate change is having on the Torres Strait.
I also accepted the evidence that indicated that when it set and communicated Australia's greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets in 2015, 2020 and 2021, the Commonwealth did not engage with or give real or genuine consideration to the best available science for it to play its part in meeting the global objective of holding the increase in global average temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels.
Speaking to supporters outside the court, Auntie McRose expressed her anger.
I have a message for the Prime Minister. Minister Bowen and Minister Watt, we see you. How dare you? Wake up. The world is watching. Our fearless ancestors are watching.
And that's Torres Strait Islander Elder McRose Ellu with Elizabeth Cramsey reporting. Now to Papua New Guinea, where the Royal PNG Constabulary is organising a special event involving police bands from several Pacific Island nations. For the first time ever, the Pacific Police Band Tattoo will be held in Port Moresby on July 22nd. The tattoo is part of the country's 50th independence anniversary, which will be celebrated later in September this year. With bands representing Micronesia, Melanesia and Polynesia, Police Inspector Lucas Neig is the Principal Director of Music with the PNG Police Band, and he spoke with Caroline Terman.
The Pacific Police Military Tattoo, the idea was brought up by our current police commissioner, and he was thinking about bringing the band around the Pacific area to come up and, you know, celebrate with us during our 50th independence Golden Jubilee.
Which bands from the region are going to be taking part in this tattoo?
So the band around the Pacific that are coming up to participate in the Pacific Police Tattoo are Fiji Police Band, the Tonga Police Band, Nauru Police Band, the Samoa Police Band, Solomon Island Police Band, and then the combined mass band from New Zealand and Australian police pipes and drums. And then the host country, the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary, and also I believe the Correctional Services Band will also participating as well.
With the police bands coming to Port Moresby, has this happened in the past?
No, not that I can remember. My memory cannot tell me there's a tattoo like this happened in Papua New Guinea before. It'll be the first time that we're going to have this one in Papua New Guinea during our Golden Jubilee year. So, you know, to coincide with our independence, the police tattoo will happen 2 months earlier, which is on the 22nd of this month.
There are several places, I guess, in the city of Port Moresby where the tattoo could be held, but is there a specific place that the bands will be playing at?
The tattoo will be staged here in Port Moresby, and it will happen at the main Tibetari Stadium. That's where, you know, all major events will be taking place, and the tattoo will also be taking place on that area as well.
I remember the Papua New Guinea Police Band during the early days. On a Sunday, we always went to Ella Beach, where Mr. Tom Shacklady used to be there with the band or leading the band.
Right.
That was just like so exciting on Sundays. But this one is going to be another level, isn't it?
Yes, correct. Carol, you are right. Those are the times that we used to perform on a Sunday afternoon. On a Sunday morning, that along Ella Beach, where we had the public there, you know, those were the time. But this event that will be happening here is it's a total different one, where it's more like a competition. But, you know, actually, it's an opportunity for us to, you know, exchange, you know, our culture and all this stuff. So it will be an opportunity to meet, you know, and mingle around with our Pacific brothers.
The music that the police bands bring out every time they are out there, like in PNG or the PNG police band go overseas, it's always exciting because sometimes you see some police band members do certain things like dance or things like that. So what about the music that you will all be exhibiting during the time?
Yeah, all the bands that will be, you know, coming up, they will have their own, you know, like displays on, you know, to be put up on the day. Musical drills and all kinds of other entertainment that they will have to, individual band will have to, you know, put them up. And then I hope that, you know, there will be judges there to judge, you know, the whoever, you know, put up a top display, and then it can be awarded with, you know, like gifts and all this stuff. So yeah, definitely all the band that they will put up their own displays, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or 15 minutes of displays, and then so the next band comes on and put up their own displays, and that's it. Yeah, that'll be the, you know, event on the 22nd.
Is the community in Port Moresby looking forward to this? It's going to be so exciting for everyone.
Sure, certainly. Message has been going on through our social media platforms and print media. I think the tattoo has been, you know, publicized. So yeah, I hope that plenty people will be, you know, there to witness the event.
And it's free?
It's free. It's free. Ticketed, but it's free, yeah.
And that's Police Inspector Lucas Negg, Principal Director of Music, with the PNG Police Band, speaking there with Caroline Terriman. Switching to sport now, it's semi-finals day at the OFC Women's Nations Cup tournament in Fiji. But the lineup is not quite what the pundits were expecting. After the host nation slipped up against Vanuatu in their final pool match, they'll now be up against the reigning champions, Papua New Guinea. The other semi-final features Solomon Islands and Samoa, and as Richard Hewitt reports, whichever team wins will be heading to a Nations Cup final for the first time.
Chance here for Kitiona. Oh, 18th minute of play. Oteta Kitiona finishes it, makes it 2-0 Samoa. Malia Joseph once again. Oh, what a shot! Malia Joseph with a cracker off a finish.
The Samoans sealed their spot in the last four with an emphatic win over Tahiti. And their coach, Juan Chang Uria, cannot speak highly enough of a team that features two of his under-17 World Cup squad at the heart of their defence.
Super proud of the girls. Despite the youth of our team, you know, only an age average of 19 years of age, you know, we got our two centre-backs, they only turned 16, our goalie, 18, you know, and super proud that the girls take us all the way to semifinals in Suva. For us, it's a blessing, you know, to have a pathway for the girls, you know, from the 16s to the 19s to the 20s. To now this year national team, you know, we have seen the growth. We have a blueprint to how Samoa football is going to look in a couple of years. You know, it looks like a really bright future for us. So we just have to continue to give them trust, give them guidance, and most important, just give them a lot of aloha, you know, from everyone, you know, Samoa.
Solomon Islands head coach Moses Tuata is also in a very positive frame of mind after his side thrashed Tonga 5-0 in their final group game.
He had a chance for Peggy. Peggy has only the goalkeeper to beat, and she does. Great work again from the combination between Arukau and Peggy. And Arukau here with the opportunity. Still Arukau, and she does well. She finishes up.
Wonderful goal from Madeline Arukau. 5-0 Solomon Islands.
Amazing. I can't express how I feel. So absolutely happy with the girls.
Did you expect this 5-0?
Actually, yeah. We came in with a determination to try and score a good number of goals. We knew how Tonga play, and so we created a plan, and we came very confident. But I told them not to be under pressure in qualifying for the semis, but to just play the game and keep passing the ball and creating opportunities. And they did.
It was a result that left the Solomons team on top of Group B and meant they would avoid title holders PNG as they bid to make their first ever final. Host nation Fiji were many people's favourites at the start of the tournament, but they almost bombed out against Vanuatu. And to make matters worse, their captain was sent off, although it has to be said, in rather mysterious and rather drawn-out circumstances.
So play stop because the referee and the assistant are in a meeting. And the result of the meeting is a red card to Jotivini Tambua. Shot from Vanuatu, it's in the goal! That is a brilliant strike from Vanuatu, Lemata Simon.
One more goal conceded by Fiji in that loss and they would have been out altogether, but they survived and their star player Trina Davis is back on the park. However, coach Angeline Chua says her squad is doing it tough and now they'll have to manage without their skipper after that red card. She's been suspended for the semi-final and the final as well if Fiji make it.
I think it's really mentally draining for the players. You know, maybe they don't even know they're qualified for semis. You know, we are not taking anything lightly. Meeting PNG, if we want to come out the strongest in the Oceania region, we have to win all the games. So much fighting spirit in the team. We have to make sure the players recover well, strategize for the next game.
Leave New Zealand out of the equation and PNG are the undisputed queens of Pacific soccer. They've won every Pacific Games gold medal since women's football was introduced. And in 2022, they won the OFC Nations Cup for the first time when, yes, their opponents were Fiji. And they head into yet another showdown with the coolists in confident mood after sweeping Cook Islands aside in their final Group A match.
Chance here for PNG, Kaipu, and it's headed in. And PNG Butubu finishes off that move. And already Papua New Guinea on the score sheets. It's a long one up high. Napa makes a hash of it, and PNG gifted their eighth goal here.
PNG coach Erickson Komang admits to having paid little attention to the form of his semi-final opponents until the group winners were decided.
Our group is a good group for us to play, and my concern and worry was about our pool match. Once we finish and I look at that, we've done it a few years ago. I know the girls can do it again. It's up to them, and we just look forward for the semi-final.
One thing Coach Komeng didn't mention, though, is while PNG certainly did win the OFC Nations Cup last time around, and for the very first time in their history, the PNG FA dispensed with the services of their winning coach Nicolas Demain just a month later, without ever really explaining why. In the Pacific, winners aren't always grinners, it would appear.
And there's Richard Hewitt looking ahead to the OFC Women's Nations Cup semi-finals, with Fiji kicking off against PNG at 3 p.m. Suva time, to be followed by Samoa up against Solomon Islands at 7 p.m.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, villagers in Samoa say they were blindsided by the decision to leave the sunken New Zealand Navy vessel Manawa Nui where it lies.
We're concerned that if the ship stays underwater, rusting metal could harm coral reefs and marine life. And if the Samoa and New Zealand governments have agreed to leave it there, our village was not informed.
And that was Tafutuala Village Mayor Taluai Leono Vasasou speaking via translator Nick Sass. You can find those top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But as always, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o toa o whātou, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.